Moreover, the Lord said unto me, Take thee a great roll, and write in it with a man's pen concerning Mahershalel Hashbez. And I took unto me faithful witnesses to record, Uriah the priest, and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. And I went unto the prophetess, and she conceived, and bare a son. Then said the Lord to me, Call his name Mahershalel Hashbez. For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, My father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. The Lord spake also unto me again, saying, Forasmuch as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh, that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son. Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria, and all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels, and go over all his banks. And he shall pass through Judah, and he shall overflow and go over, and he shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of the land, O Emmanuel. Associate yourselves, O ye people, and ye shall be broken in pieces, and give ear, all ye of far countries, gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces, gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught, speak the word, and it shall not stand, for God is with us. For the Lord spake thus to me with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk away in the way of this people, saying, Say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say, A confederacy, neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. And he shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, for a gin and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. And I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. And when they shall say unto you, Seek unto them that have familiar spirits, and unto the wizards that peep and that mutter, should not a people seek unto their God for the living to the dead? To the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. And they shall pass through it hardly bestead and hungry. And it shall come to pass that when they shall be hungry, and shall fret themselves, and curse their king and their God, and look upward. And they shall look unto the earth, and behold the trouble and darkness, dimness of anguish, and they shall be driven to darkness.
This morning we'd like to talk about Isaiah chapter 8 for Sunday school. This will be, I think, a good review because we've been doing Isaiah in the readings this week, and I think that you'll find this somewhat familiar ground. Also, our exhortation was on Isaiah 7, and we finished up at Isaiah 7 and verse 14, dealing with the work of Emmanuel. Now, Isaiah 7 and verse 15 says, Butter and honey shall he eat, that's the child. When, as the Hebrew indicates, when he may know to refuse the evil and to choose the good. You know, that verse is telling us that even a child had more sense of morality than did Ahaz, king of Judah. Who was this child? Well, we shall find out in due course who it in fact was. But I want you to notice from verse 16 that before this child would grow to some sense of maturity, the land that Ahaz abhorred would be forsaken of both her kings, Rezin and Pekah. So all the problems that Ahaz was concerned about, with Syria being confederate with Ephraim, by the time that this child grew to maturity, those kings would be removed from the land. the question we want to find out is, who was this particular child that verses 15 and 16 speak of? Well, that's where chapter 8 comes in, because chapter 8 explains who that child was, who the Emmanuel of that day was. Ultimately, of course, we know that these verses refer to Christ in the greater sense. But as far as the application in that day was concerned, there was a child that the prophet was referring to. And Isaiah chapter 8 is going to tell us who that in fact was. Well, Rezin and Pekah were to be taken off the scene, but there was an even greater power that was on the rise. Verse 17 says, Yahweh shall bring upon thee and upon thy people and upon thy father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. And then that day shall come to pass that Yahweh shall hiss for the fly that is in the uttermost part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. And as we know, the Assyrians in ancient times were the most cruel and the most rapacious of all the powers. The Assyrians used to pile up the heads of the people that they killed outside the city as a witness to their cruelty. You can go to the British Museum and see the great friezes of Lachish, which were like the photographs of the day. It's horrible stuff. And this Assyrian was about to make its way into the land of Judah. Chapter 8 is going to tell us about that as well. The word hiss in verse 18, I always found this very, very interesting. It's not the hissing of a serpent. Actually, it's the Hebrew word whistle. So God would just whistle a certain tune, and the Assyrians would come. You know, that was the ancient method of beekeeping. You know, today we have people that go in with, you know, smoke cloths and go in and get the honey. But in those days, the beekeeper could just whistle a certain tune, and the bees would go. The bees would follow. Well, that's the way that God is when He wants a nation to come. He just whistles. And like that ancient beekeeper, they listened to his tune. And he would whistle for the Assyrian. And verses 19 to 25 of this chapter describe the devastation by the Assyrian on the northern part of the land, the ten tribes. Not so much Judah, but the northern part of the land. The Assyrians would come. And verse 20 says it was like a razor being going across somebody and shaving off all the hair, even to the hairy feet. And it shall also consume the beard. Under the law of Moses, when a razor came across somebody, it was a symbol of a new beginning. Well, now God would take a razor and he would bring the Assyrian. And the Assyrian would bring a new beginning for the ten tribes. In verses 23, 24, and 25, I want you to notice there's a recurring expression, briars and thorns, briars and thorns, briars and thorns. It's like Genesis all over again. The promise of the seed of the woman was rejected in verse 14, and man was driven from the garden, and thorns and thistles came across the whole of that land. In fact, it was so bad that verse 25 said that you wouldn't even go in there with a hoe. Verse 25 in the Interlinear Bible says, "On all the hills that shall be hoed with a hoe, you shall not come thither for fear of thorns and briars, but it shall be for the sending forth of oxen and for the treading of lesser cattle." So these briars and thorns would be so thick across the land that you wouldn't even go in there, not even with a hoe. And all you could do is send the cows out there and hope that maybe they could do some damage to those briars and thorns, but you dare not go in there yourself. And chapter 8 says, moreover. Moreover. So we're not going to find out who the Emmanuel of that day was. We're going to see that chapter 8 is really very much an explanation of chapter 7. So who was the Emmanuel in that day? Now, an idea that's gained some traction in the Brotherhood is that Hezekiah was the Emmanuel of that day. And whilst Hezekiah was a remarkable man and a type of Jesus Christ, there is this particular question that we have to answer. How old was Hezekiah when the Emmanuel promise was given? Was he born? Was he alive? Well, it'd be nice to have this on an overhead, but Ahaz began to reign at age 20. He reigned for 16 years. So he started at 20, ended at 36. Not a very long reign, actually, just as well. Hezekiah began his reign at age 25. Hezekiah was Ahaz's son. So that means that Ahaz fathered Hezekiah at age 11. You take 25 from 36, you come up with 11. So one of the reasons why Hezekiah was so different from Ahaz was because Ahaz had very little to do with Hezekiah's upbringing. Hezekiah was really brought up by his mother and by his grandfather. So if Ahaz began his reign at age 20, and the promise of Emmanuel was given to him probably in his mid-20s, that meant that Hezekiah was probably a teenager when the promise of the Emmanuel was given in chapter 7. So he therefore could not be the Emmanuel of that day. But we are given the name of the person who was. In verse 1, "Moreover, Yahweh said unto me, take thee a great roll and write in it with a man's pen concerning Maher Shalal Hashbaz." You know, Shear Jashub's birth is not even mentioned in the record. But this particular child's birth was announced before conception even had taken place. So there was promise in the birth of this child. There were the dual elements of human and divine, because there was the promise of God. But verse 1 also says, write in it with a man's pen. As a matter of fact, the word man there is Enosh, weak man. Write in it with the engraving tool of a man. So there are these two elements here. There's the promise of God, the divine element, and there's the human element, the engraving tool of a man. And those are the same two elements that we saw in chapter 7. There was the birth by a woman, but there was also the Lord himself, the human and the divine. And when verse 3 says, I went into the prophetess and she conceived and bare a son, she conceived and bare a son is, of course, the same language as Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14. Now, clearly the prophetess was not a virgin in that sense, but the record is making a link between the two things. In chapter 8 and verse 4, we have this promise, for before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. And that verse, chapter 8, verse 4, is the identical promise as chapter 7, verse 16, which says, before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings. So it's the same promise. The Emmanuel of that day was Isaiah's second son, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. There was the promise given before conception took place. They had both human and divine elements. And there was this promise that before it grew to maturity, the land would be forsaken of both her kings. The Emmanuel of that day was Isaiah's second son, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. And we know that his sons were signs. Verse 18 says, behold, I and the children whom Yahweh hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel. Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Does anybody know what that means? Yes, it's kind of a double. It's make speed to the spoil, haste to the prey. Maher, if you just want to break this up, maybe if you're taking notes, Maher means to hasten or to make speed. Shalal means spoil. Hash, to hurry or make haste. And Baz, prey or booty. I wonder what his nickname was. Maybe Bazar, perhaps, we don't know. But there was a significance in this boy's name of making speed to the spoil and hasting to the prey. Now, in this particular chapter, it is judgment on behalf of Judah, because in verse 4, it says, "For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil." That word there, spoil, in verse 4 is the Hebrew word shalal, which is in the name Meher Shalahashbaz. "The spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria." So in chapter 8, it was judgment on behalf of Judah. But when we come over to chapter 10 and verse 6, we see it's judgment against Judah. So there's like a double-edged sword in the meaning of this child's name. 10 verse 6 says, "I will send him," that is the Assyrian, "against the hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge, to take the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like mire in the streets." So this boy of Isaiah's was a sign to the nation. In chapter 8, it meant the removal of Rezin and Pekah. Their spoil would be taken away. But in chapter 10, it spoke of the coming of the Assyrian. And as people looked at this boy of Isaiah's, they would be reminded of that lesson. This boy is speaking of judgment to come. He was a sign to the nation. And God wanted everybody to know about this boy. Because back in chapter 8 and verse 1, Yahweh said unto me, "Take thee a great roll." The Hebrew word is used of a large placard. You can almost say that this boy was written in the volume of the book, to use the word of Psalm 40. This great roll, and writing on it, Meher Shalal Hashbaz, and displaying it for everybody to see, so that everybody in Judah would know what the signs of the times were. Because that boy was the epitome of what it represented. How careful would that boy have had to have acted amongst the people in Judah? You know, you couldn't be this messenger for God, this sign for God, and be fooling around with the world. How careful, not just this boy, but Shear Jashub and Isaiah and the whole family would have had to have been acted. Because if they had been unfaithful, if they had been hypocritical, it would have completely undermined the message. They were to be ambassadors for Christ, as we are to be. You know, we're not signs in the sense of Meher Shel Hashbaz, but we are, as the Apostle says, ambassadors for Christ. And people ought to be able to look at us and see a difference. To ensure that everybody knew, the prophet in verse 2 took faithful witnesses to record. Doesn't necessarily mean these were faithful men, but he took faithful witnesses to record, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. Now the second man we know nothing about, but the first man we do. Who was this Uriah the priest? I'd like you to come back to 2 Kings chapter 16. Because these men were chosen very, very carefully. Uriah, his name means light of Yahweh, but tragically he was full of darkness. 2 Kings 16, verse 10. "And King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest." Now you might see the margin, Urijah and Uriah are the same name in the Hebrew. Urijah the priest, the fashion of the altar and the pattern of it according to all the workmanship thereof. And Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. That was how that Syrian altar got in the temple. It was because this guy Urijah, the priest, brought it there. And God wanted him to be one of the witnesses to this transaction. Now we can speculate. Was he Isaiah's friend and then he went rotten? Or was he rotten all along? And God specifically wanted this man, this unfaithful man, to witness this transaction as a lesson to him and to all the unfaithful in Judah. We don't know. But I imagine God would have chosen those people very carefully. Well, in Isaiah chapter 8, we see that conception took place. And I went unto the prophetess, and she conceived and bare a son. Now that's interesting. Isaiah's wife was a prophetess. Now unfortunately, none of her visions are recorded. But perhaps she was involved in the work of a prophet as well. Perhaps she witnessed to the female community in Judah. Subject to her husband, yes, but a prophetess nonetheless. She probably would have suffered her fair share of rejection too, as the wife of Isaiah. Isaiah married well. Isaiah picked a woman who also was dedicated to the things of God. He married well, and she married well too. When we find partners, as we know, it's not just about finding someone who's in the truth. It's about finding someone who is dedicated and loves the truth more than you do. They both married well. And she conceived and bare a son. Then Yahweh said unto me, call his name Maher Shalahashbaz. For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother. Now notice that. Father and mother. Brother Thomas said, children are best reared when parents are well married. And there's the ideal household. Not just mom, not just dad, but mom and dad working together. Before he would cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away from before the king of Assyria. And Yahweh spake unto me again, saying, for as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloah that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son. Now chapter 8 provides a number of links to chapter 7. We've already seen one of them in verse 3. She conceived and bare a son. But verse 6, for as much as this people refuseth, that's a contrast to the child. If you come back to chapter 7 and verse 16, for before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good. So you see, Maher Shalahashbaz refused evil and chose good. This particular group of people refused the waters of Shiloah and rejoiced in Rezin and Remaliah's son. So here was another faction in the ecclesia of Judah. They were looking forward to a change of government. They were looking forward to the son of Tabeel coming in. They were fatalist. And they were just as bad as Ahaz. They refused the waters of Shiloah. Now, where did we see the waters of Shiloah? Of course, that's chapter 7 and verse 3, isn't it? The upper pool, which is the pool of Siloam. Siloam and Shiloah are the same word in the Hebrew. In the highway of the fuller's field. And it was that place where the sign of Emmanuel was given. Well, there was a faction of people in Judah that refused that sign. They were looking forward to a foreign ruler coming in and taking over the ecclesia. They refused the waters of Shiloh, which was the promise of the virgin birth. And you know, I think that there's something interesting about that description. What does chapter 8 and verse 6 say about these waters? It says they go softly. The water was brought from the Gihon spring, and it softly flowed down into the pool of Siloam where it bubbled up and people could wash their garments. That's a wonderful description, really, of the truth, isn't it? You think about the daily readings. You think about the things that we do in the truth. There's no drama or fanfare about that. It's a calming, unobtrusive influence. You know, the Word of God is not this raging torrent that destroys. It is refreshing. It goes softly. It's like the still small voice that you learn about in the life of Elijah. There's no drama or fanfare about the daily readings and the things we do in the truth, but they are absolutely essential to our life in the truth. It's like going without water. If we don't take in the Word every day, you can't last very long without water. Deuteronomy chapter 32. I've always loved this verse. You know, the Word of God is not so much a raging torrent. It's not like the Assyrian that we're going to read of in a minute that's overflowing all of its banks and destroying everything. It's a calming, refreshing influence in our lives. You know, it's not as exciting as maybe some of the things you'll find out there in the world, but it's absolutely critical to what we need. Here's what Deuteronomy says about the Word. Deuteronomy 32, verse 1. Give ear, O ye heavens, and I will speak. And hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. My doctrine shall drop as the rain. My speech shall distill as the dew. You see, it's like calming, refreshing, soothing. That's what the Word of God is. As the small rain upon the tender herb, and as the showers on the grass. That's the Word of God. It's calming. It's refreshing. It's soothing. It's the waters of Shiloh that go softly. And that influence we need to partake of every day of our lives. This faction in Judah rejected it. They didn't want any part of the truth. They didn't want any part of the signs that God has given. There's going to be a message for us in this chapter that we need to drink deeply of it. Well, because they rejected the soft, living, refreshing waters of Shiloh, what would they get? Well, Isaiah chapter 8 tells us they're going to get a flood. And there's something very poetic about that. Chapter 8 tells us who that flood was. Verse 7. Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river. The word river there is the word Nahal, which is used of great rivers like the Euphrates. Strong and many, even the king of Assyria, and all his glory. And he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. And he shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over. Now you see the emphasis? Going over, passing over. It was like a raging flood. He shall reach even unto the neck. And the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. Now let me just ask some questions here to keep you all awake. Where have we read wings in Isaiah before? Wings. Specifically six wings. Right, Isaiah 6. Just flip back to Isaiah 6. Chapter 6 is really the answer to that question in chapter 5. What more could I do for my vineyard? What more? He asked in chapter 5. One more thing. He could send them the prophet. Chapter 6. Well, now, these seraphim have been unleashed. And it calls them, in chapter 8 and verse 8, the stretching out of his wings. Because the Assyrian was performing this judgment on behalf of God. The seraphim were using the Assyrian to judge Judah. But I want you to notice, if you just read carefully, there's a hint of salvation in verse 8. Can anybody see where it is? There's a hint of salvation. How do we know? How far would the Assyrian go? Right. What's the word that would fit that in verse 8. Neck. So the water would come up and up and up and up and up, but it would stop at the neck. And of course, we know what happened, don't we? The Assyrian overflowed Judah, took 46 cities, came right to the edge of Jerusalem, but they went no further. So there's a hint there of salvation. And that would have been a great comfort to the remnant, the few faithful that were in Judah, who Shear-Jashub, the other son of Isaiah, represented. There's this promise they can trust in that, yes, the Assyrian will come. Yes, we will have some major problems, but he won't destroy us. It's just like the trials in our life. We're never promised happy times. If anything, we're promised the opposite. We are promised that God isn't going to destroy us. And those problems will come right up to our neck, but they'll stop. And we'll be delivered if we put our trust in Emmanuel. Now the land in verse 8 is called Emmanuel's land. You can imagine Isaiah and his wife sitting, you know, at home having their conversation. And boy, I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall in that house, listening to those conversations that those two had around the word. And they're having this conversation, and Isaiah would have said, "Dear, you know, I've had this wonderful vision today, and the land is called Emmanuel's land. Their boy, Maher Shel Ahashbaz. It's called Emmanuel's land." Now, why is the land called Emmanuel's land? Now, I'm going to defer the answer to that, because I think verse 10 explains it to us. But the land is called Emmanuel's land. And you could either believe in the promise that God had made in chapter 7, or you can do what the class in verse 9 did. You could form a confederacy to resist of your own. "Associate yourselves, O ye people, and ye shall be broken in pieces. And give ear, all ye of far countries. Gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces." You know, in Judah, there would have been all different classes of people. There was the faithful class, the remnant. There was the fatalist class, in verse 6. And then there was another class of people that said, "Well, you know, let's run to Egypt. Maybe they can help us. Let's run to Assyria. Maybe we can appease them through an alliance." And these groups of people would be associating together. And you can see the remnant there saying, "No, we need to trust in God. He can deliver us from the Assyrian. It's only going to come to the neck." There have been others who have been saying, "Well, you know, let's strike a deal with them, so maybe they won't destroy us." When we come back to 2 Kings 16, this is what Ahaz did. And this is just incredible. Ahaz refused the sign of chapter 7, the sign of the virgin birth, the sign of the Son of God. So what did Ahaz do? 2 Kings 16, verse 7. "So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, 'I am thy servant and thy son. Come up and Isaiah me out of the king of Assyria.'" You know, chapter 7 was all about God saving his people through the Son. Ahaz says, "Sorry, not interested." Now he takes that language and uses it to the king of Assyria. You see that? "I am thy servant and thy son." That was what Isaiah wanted him to believe in chapter 7, that God could do. "Come and save me out of the hand of the king of Syria and out of the king of Israel, which rise up against me." But the alliance backfired. I get to come to 2 Chronicles, to the companion account. 2 Chronicles chapter 28. The psalm says, "Put not your trust in princes, nor the son of man in whom is no help." When we have problems, we can either go to the world, go to the doctors, go to the philosophers, go to the wise men of the world and see if we get help from them, or we can go to God. Verse 19. "For Yahweh brought Judah low because of Ahaz, king of Israel. Notice anything interesting about that? Just by the way, Ahaz, king of Israel. Ahaz was the king of Israel. He was king of Judah. But you see, the record is telling us he was characteristically a king of Israel. He was just like all those up in there in the north who were evil. For he made Judah naked and transgressed sore against Yahweh. And Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came unto him and distressed him, but strengthened him not. For Ahaz took a portion out of the house of Yahweh and out of the house of the king and of the princes and gave it to the king of Assyria. But he helped him not. So the alliance backfired. That's exactly what Isaiah said would happen. Associate yourselves and you'll be broken to pieces. Put not your trust in princes, nor the son of man wherein is no help. We'll come back to Isaiah chapter 8. And verse 10. I ask the question, why is the land called Emmanuel's land? Well, verse 10 says, take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand. For ale is with us. Emmanuel. Ale is with us. Now, who are the us of that verse? The us would be the faithful remnant. If you're not with the faithful remnant, then ale is not with you. And that's why the land, of course, is called in verse 8, Emmanuel's land. God would bring the Assyrian, but he would only come up to the neck. Why? Because there was a group of faithful that he was going to save. And if you're not with that group of faithful, if you're taking counsel somewhere else, if you're going to the world for help, he's not with you. And if he's not with you, then there's no way you're fighting against the Assyrian and winning. That's why it's called Emmanuel's land. The question we have to ask ourselves, of course, is, am I part of the remnant? Is that power that we spoke of earlier really with us? Well, God then had a personal message for Isaiah. Verse 11. For Yahweh spake thus to me with a strong hand. You can imagine the prophet, or God, almost reaching down and grabbing the prophet and saying, listen to me. He instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, say ye not a confederacy, to all whom this people shall say a confederacy. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. You see, people were saying, look, Rezin and Pekah are united. The Assyrian's on his way. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? But God said to him, don't you dare walk in the way of that people. Don't fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. It's like God is saying, Isaiah, I know the way that other brothers and sisters are going, that are running to the world for help, that are going down to Egypt for help, but I don't want you to walk in that way. Don't you dare walk in the way of this people. I want you to sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself. Now, where have we heard that phrase, himself? Well, that's chapter 7 and verse 14, isn't it? Therefore the Lord himself. And we saw that God was personally involved in the sending forth of this son. God says to the prophet, sanctify Yahweh of, notice this, it's armies, a greater army than Assyria, himself. The truth has got to mean something personal to us. It can't just be academic. You know, the same phrase is used in Hebrews 11 of Sarah. It doesn't just say that Sarah had faith. It says that Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed. She really came to believe and feel God's presence in her life. Initially, we know she laughed. But Sarah herself received strength. Sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself, and let him be your fear. And I just love Rotherham's translation here. And let him inspire you with awe. I'll read that again. Let him be your fear, and let him inspire you with awe. People stood in awe of the Assyrian, its might and its power. God says, I want you to be inspired by me. In 1 Peter chapter 3, the ecclesia was going through a period of terrible persecution at the hands of Nero. Nero wanted to tear down Rome and build a new one, but the Senate wouldn't give him the land. So what he did was, he burnt it down and he blamed it on the Christians. And he called for worldwide persecution against the ecclesia. And Asia Minor was one of those areas where that was taken up. So Peter looks through the whole Old Testament and he says, I want to come up with a verse that fits this situation. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 12, the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous and his ears are open unto their prayers, but the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. And who is he that will harm you if you be followers of that which is good? But and if ye suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are you. And here's the words from Isaiah. Be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh. Now Peter changed something. Well, he didn't really change something. He kind of interpreted something from the Isaiah quote. What did he change from Isaiah chapter 8. Isaiah said, sanctify the Lord himself. What does Peter say? Sanctify the Lord God in your hearts. It's deep down. It means something to you. It's personal. When something's in your heart, you know, it's personal. And that's the remedy to not fearing the trials that are coming upon you. If you've got an army in your heart in the form of Yahweh, if he means something to you and you really believe what he says, then you're not going to fear what even the Assyrian or even a brute like Nero might do to you. Because you've already got an army that's stronger in your hearts. So Peter looked over all the Old Testament and he said, there is a case where there was a remnant back there in Isaiah chapter 8. There was a remnant that had sanctified God in their hearts. And when the Assyrian came, those that had faith in that Emmanuel promise were delivered. Now I want you to do the same. Now we don't face invading armies today, but we do have problems. We do have trials that sometimes feel like we're fighting an uphill battle. And we have to sanctify Yahweh of hosts in our hearts. When we come back to Isaiah chapter 8, we'll just have a few more thoughts. There were two things you could do. You could either believe in that promise, and it would be a sanctuary, or you could not believe that promise, and you could stumble and fall. Isaiah 8 and verse 14. And he shall be for a sanctuary. Rotherham says, a hallowed asylum. Now that's interesting. Because what did Ahaz done to the sanctuary in that day? He had desecrated it. It's almost as though God saying, well, don't worry about that sanctuary that he set up. Make me your sanctuary. Make me your hallowed asylum. Rise to the occasion and believe in what I've given you. But if you don't believe, you'll be for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel. And of course, these words are quoted in Peter in regards to the reaction that would be produced by the Son of God. There would be some that would rise to it and would become part of the sanctuary. And there would be others that would trip and fall. It's alluded to by Simeon in Luke when he looked at Mary and he said, this child, he picked up the words of Isaiah 7 and 8. This child is set for the rise and the fall of many in Israel. And he says many hearts are going to be revealed. One thing that the truth does And one thing that trials do is they reveal who you really are. Somebody once told me we're all like tea bags. We all look the same when you get a tea bag out of the little thing. You know, a tea bag is a tea bag is a tea bag. You don't know the quality of the tea until you put it in hot water. And then who you really are comes out. You know the quality of the tea once it's dipped in the hot water. And the truth does that. It reveals who we really are. And we can either make God our sanctuary and have a calm, quiet, confident trust in Him, or we can stumble. We can panic. We can act like Ahaz. And many, verse 15, among them shall stumble and fall and broken and be snared and taken. You know, it's interesting that when you don't accept God into your life, it seems like your life just gets worse and worse, doesn't it? It doesn't just say that they would stumble in verse 15. It says they will stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken. Their life will just continue to unravel and get worse and worse. The further they went away from God, the worse their life got. Well, things had gotten so bad in the nation that even Isaiah himself had to retreat from public ministry. In verse 16, he's told, "Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples." Now, it appears that Isaiah temporarily retreated from his public ministry. You see, because when you bind something up and you seal it, you conceal it. And if people wanted to know about that, they would go and find him. They would expend the effort to go and find him and learn what he was really teaching. And you know, that's what the truth has to be for us. If we want the truth, if we want to get anything out of it, we've got to put the time in. We've got to expend ourselves for it. It's not just going to be handed to us. We've got to want to know. We've got to want to get closer to God. Our final quotation, we'll cite from Matthew chapter 5. Because I think Matthew 5 is making an allusion to this section in Isaiah. There were two groups in Isaiah chapter 8. There would be those who would rise to the occasion and become a sanctuary. And there was a class called many who would stumble and fall. The class in Isaiah chapter 8 was called his disciples. Hezekiah was probably one of those disciples that was in Isaiah's little group. Well, we've got the same picture in Matthew chapter 4 and Matthew chapter 5. The Lord Jesus Christ is healing, and of course there are some who are following him just to see the miracles. Matthew 4 and verse 25, "And there followed him great multitudes of people." So there were many from Galilee, from Decapolis, from Jerusalem, from Judea, and from beyond Jordan. "And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. And when he was set," who was it that came unto him? Was it all the multitudes? Was it the people that were just looking for bread? It was only his disciples that came unto him. Isaiah chapter 8 gave this picture of many people stumbling and falling, unable to put their trust in the sign that God had given them. And then there was another little group that the law was sealed amongst. And they were called in Isaiah chapter 8, disciples. Well, who was gathered to him on this occasion? It was his disciples. The people that really wanted to learn, the people that really wanted to put their trust in God and make him their sanctuary, were willing to climb the mountain, to encounter difficulty, to sit at his feet and to listen to what he had to say. They had to make the effort to follow Christ. It wasn't going to be easy, but the ones that were willing to do it, they heard the speech of Matthew 5, 6, and 7. None of the multitudes down on the mountain heard it, because they saw he wasn't going to do any more miracles that day. It was only his disciples. So there's the lesson here, brothers and sisters, that we have to, if we want to get anything out of the truth, we have to put a lot into it. We're not going to get a lot out of it if we put a little into it. We have to be willing to give our time, to give our energy, that we might get the maximum out of it. And there was that class of people in the Lord's day, just as there was in Isaiah's day. Do we have any time left? I don't know what time I was supposed to stop.
I think that's about it.
Okay. Pardon?
I will get the crew if you want to field any comments from the...
Sure. We kind of blew through that, so...
Maybe when you read Isaiah 8 better than Daniel, it's awesome.
But it's just when you have to be hot water to bring up the truth.
Right, you have to be under pressure.
When
they say you're
in hot water,
yes, God's bringing it. You can either put your trust in the promise that you've given, the Emmanuel, or you can do other things. You can go to the world. You get involved in pleasure. Distract you. You have to go to God with it in this situation. Just a question. Verse 19, when it says, "When they shall say unto you," who's the you? The you would be the remnant. When they shall say unto you, "Speak unto them that have familiar spirit, who withers his teeth and mutter." You see, there would be people who would be trying to influence the remnant, saying, "You know, you really believe what Isaiah is telling you? You know, why don't you go to the familiar spirits and solve it?" The you there is the remnant. It's always just helpful to identify who the pronouns are referring to. They would be under pressure to get in.